Hi, I'm Rami Kurukji. I'm the clinical director for malignant hematology department at H.L.E. Moffitt Cancer Center, and I'm the lead clinical investigator for the myelodysplastic program. I would like to welcome you to this brief educational session where we would cover risk assessment for myelodysplastic syndromes. As you know, myelodysplastic syndromes are a heterogeneous group of malignant neoplastic stem cell diseases characterized by bone marrow failure with resultant cytopenias and related complications. Namely, macrocytic anemia is the most common cytopenia, but thrombocytopenia and neutropenia are not infrequent. The hallmark of the disease pathologically is the presence of dysplasia and the accelerated apoptosis early on. There is a tendency to progress to acute myeloid leukemia. All over around 30 to 40% of the patients will progress to acute myeloid leukemia. However, unfortunately, more than 60% of the patients will succumb to the disease and its related complications. MDS is disease of elderly, the median age of diagnosis is around 70, and the current estimates that there's probably around 40 to 50,000 new cases diagnosed each year in the United States. So why to risk stratify MDS patients, or why should we stage those patients? I think we apply the principle of staging or risk stratification in any type of oncologic disease we deal with. Staging provides prognostic information for the patient and treating physicians. It's a forecast for how the patient disease will behave. And more importantly, probably it serves as a tool or decision tool for us to tailor the therapy accordingly. And in MDS, we are particularly thinking of therapy that could alter the natural history of the disease, such as allogeneic stem cell transplant, where we weigh the benefit of cure versus the risk of transplant-related mortality. Also, with the implication of azanucleosides and higher-risk MDS and their impact on survival, risk stratification may identify patients with higher risk that could benefit from those treatments. So when we think of prognostic factors in MDS, we could think of them as disease-related factors, such as percentage of myeloblasts, degree and depth of cytopenia, the karyotype, molecular mutations of the MDS clone, factors such as presence of fibrosis in the bone marrow, transfusion burdens. But we also have to think of host-related factors, such as the age of the patient, their functional or performance status, presence of comorbidities, and other factors. There are several risk models or staging systems used in MDS. The FAB classification, the French-American-British classification, or the WHO classification, the Health World Organization classification, the World Health Organization classification, are based on pathology. There are more clinical prognostic models, such as the International Prognostic System, the IPSS, the revised IPSS, the WHO prognostic scoring system, mostly used in Europe. And there are also two models developed by MD Anderson, the global MD Anderson risk model, and a specific risk model for the lower risk developed by Dr. Guillermo Garcia Manero. The IPSS is probably the most common tool for risk stratification in MDS, and it's probably widely used in the community. This model was originally published by Dr. Greenberg in Blood in 1997. One would assess three important variables: presence of myeloblasts, the karyotype, whether patients are divided into three groups of good, intermediate, or poor, and presence of cytopenia, whether the patients are only anemic, neutropenic, or they have two to three cytopenia lines, basically. And the patient is given score, which is a lump score based on those three variables. Patients are divided into one out of four categories: the low, intermediate one, intermediate two, or high risk category. And based on that, the median survival for somebody who's a low risk MDS is estimated around 5.7 years versus somebody who's higher risk, the median survival is less than half a year. So patients who are risk stratified as intermediate 2 or high risk are patients with unfortunately poor expected outcome, which could be compared to patients with metastatic lung cancer or pancreatic cancer, a thing which commonly we don't think of in MDS. Now, you know, the IPSS had been used widely. The community had adapted IPSS. It had been used for the eligibility criteria on clinical studies. But there is no doubt that for all of us who use the IPSS, we recognize certain shortcomings of the system. So the revised IPSS is an attempt to refine the prognostic value of the IPSS and address some of those shortcomings. The first change in the revised IPSS is really a more depth analysis of the impact of karyotypes. We're now in the revised IPSS, instead of having only three simple groups, we have five cytogenetic risk groups. We learned that presence of deletion 11q, which is a rare event, is really a very good karyotype. We learned that deletion 7q is better than monosomy 7. So now we have more depth or more information about the karyotype prognostic value. The other changes incorporated in the revised IPSS include more refining of the blast percentage, which in real life could be an issue to distinguish a blast less than 2% versus blast of 3 to 5%. However, in prognostic models, there seem to be a difference at those arbitrary cutoffs. Also, the revised IPSS addresses the limitation of the IPSS not recognizing the depth of cytopenia. We all know clinically if patient had platelets of 10, they don't do as well as patient with platelets of 90. And now the revised IPSS incorporates the depth of thrombocytopenia, neutropenia, as well as anemia into the scoring system. So based on the revised IPSS, patients will be divided actually now in five groups: very low, low, intermediate, high, and very high risk group. A patient with very low risk group is expected to have an 8.8 years survival, versus somebody who's very high risk is expected to have less than a year median survival. And the time to AML progression, where one out of four patients would progress to AML, was not reached in the clinical study in the very low risk MDS, while patients in the very high risk, one out of four patients will transform to acute myeloid leukemia in less than a year. So there is no doubt that this system is refining the prognostic value of the IPSS. It addresses some of the shortcomings. However, now we have five risk groups rather than a four risk group, and the intermediate risk group is somewhere where one could treat based on other features, either as a higher risk or lower risk. This model had been validated by several groups, including our group, where we externally validated the prognostic value of this model. And this model also can be adjusted for age, where it can be also incorporated in the model. Now, in addition to the clinical models, we've learned in the past few years about the importance of presence of molecular mutations or single gene mutations in MDS. This is mostly due to improvement in the technology assessing those molecular mutations, where now with the next generation sequencing, we are able to identify a mutation at least in one single gene in 80% of the patients with MDS. So obviously it turns out that those single gene mutations are a common event in MDS. MDS is disease of epigenetic deregulation and splicing machinery mutations. Out of those genes, several of them had a prognostic value. A seminal paper by Dr. Rafael Behar was published in the New England Journal, where they looked at more than 100 gene mutation in patients with MDS, and in multivariable analysis, they were able to identify five genes that, separate from the clinical models, had prognostic value. Those include the P53 mutation, ETV6, RUNX1, ASXL1, and EZH2 mutation. So the presence of any of those mutations will upgrade the patient from a low-risk group to an intermediate one, from intermediate 1 to intermediate 2. Once the patients obviously are higher risk, there is no more upstaging. So those will probably be incorporated in future prognostic models. There is debate or controversy whether they will add to such newer models. But some work already published indicates that they are independent or additive to even some of the newer models, like the lower risk MD Anderson model, where EZH2 still maintained prognostic value in that model. So when we start thinking of the host factors, obviously comorbidities stand out as a very important prognostic value. It have impact obviously on the overall survival for the patients, but there is no doubt that it also affect our choices of therapy. We all in practice probably assess comorbidities and functional status, not in a systemic way or based on a scoring system, but there had been several attempts to have more objective way of assessing comorbidities. The Italian MDS group published a comorbidity model in Hematologica in 2010, where they developed a score based on presence of cardiac disease, hepatic disease, pulmonary disease, renal disease, or presence of solid tumor, where patients will be assigned score or points for each of those systems. And they were able to divide the patient into three risky groups based on the comorbidity index and show that their survival was obviously different between the three risky groups. But more importantly, when this is incorporated with the WPSS, which is, as I mentioned earlier, is more widely used in Europe, they were able to refine or further risk stratify patients within each risky group of the WPSS. Other comorbidity models, such as the ACE27 model, also had been tested. This is work from MD Anderson group published by Dr. Naqvi in JCO, where they looked at the ACE27 model in MDS patients, showing its prognostic value, and also showed that it could be an additive to the clinical models used, such as the IPSS. So I wanted to bring a case study to illustrate the importance of the risk stratification and prognostic models. This is actually a true case from our clinic. 63-year-old male originally was found to have pancytopenia. He required red blood cell transfusions once a month over the past 3 months when we saw him. A bone marrow aspirate biopsy was obtained that revealed dysplasia in all three cell lines. He also had grade 3 fibrosis in the bone marrow. At the time we saw him, his hemoglobin was 8, WBC count was 2000, ANC 700, platelets were 28,000. He had 1% circulating blasts. On the bone marrow, the myeloblast estimate were 3%. Karyotype revealed presence of trisomy 8. The patient ECOG performance status was 1. His past medical history was significant for orbital pseudotumor, hypertension, and diabetes. So by the IPSS, this patient would be risk stratified as an intermediate one risk group. Our approach typically for those patients is first to verify and review the bone marrow slides, confirming the diagnosis. The next step is logically the risk stratification or staging. So this patient would be by the IPSS labeled as intermediate one with a median overall survival of 3.5 years. Now, if we start looking at this patient risk by the new models, if we use the revised IPSS risk model, actually this patient will come in a higher risk group, where the median survival is estimated about 1.6 years, and one out of four patients will transform to acute myeloid leukemia within 1 to 2 years. So this patient has risk features that the IPSS probably underestimated, such as the depth of the cytopenia, presence of more than one line cytopenia, and the bone marrow blast percentage. If we look at the global MD Anderson model that we also had validated in the past, that it has additive or refining value to the IPSS, this patient will come as an intermediate two risk group, where the median overall survival for those patients is estimated around 14 months. Also, using the lower risk MD Anderson model, this patient actually will come as a category 3 based on the cytogenetics, the anemia, the age, and the cytopenias. And those patients have also a median overall survival that's less than 2 years. I think the MD Anderson model, whether it's the global or the lower risk, incorporates factors such as age. The global MD Anderson model incorporates factors such as the functional status for the patient measured by the ECOG performance status. So originally, based on the WHO classification, this patient would have been classified MDS unclassified with fibrosis. He had 2% blast on the peripheral blood. The presence of fibrosis will make him as an MDS unclassified. By the IPSS, his risk would be intermediate 1, where one could approach this patient gradually, starting with supportive care, use of erythroid-stimulating agents, and then moving to subsequent therapies. However, when one would have a closer look by newer risk models, it will be obvious that the patient have more risk features, and our treatment recommendation was azacitidine and consideration of allogeneic stem cell transplant. The patient actually was treated with azacitidine. He had a good response originally for the azacitidine. He declined allogeneic stem cell transplantation. This is another case where we have a 58-year-old lady diagnosed with MDS after presenting with shortness of breath. Hemoglobin was 8.7, white blood cell count 6.5, platelets 90,000, and serum ferritin was 630. Original workup including B12, folate, serum creatinine were within normal limits. Peripheral smear reveals macrocytic red cells on the bone marrow, and flow cytometry and cytogenetic testing revealed presence of 3% blasts, 25% marrow cellularity, and deletion 5q in 20 out of the 20 metaphases. So the question, obviously, what would be the patient prognostic risk category according to the revised IPSS? By IPSS, this patient would have been an intermediate 1. When we look at the revised IPSS, given the 3% myeloblast, I think this patient will be an intermediate risk. So the question is, how would we treat this patient? I think this patient has MDS with isolated deletion 5q. Again, by IPSS would have been intermediate 1. By revised IPSS will be intermediate risk group. This intermediate risk group, the NCCN guidelines give leverage on treating those patients either as lower risk or higher risk based on other features, including age, LDH, ferritin, and other factors. In this case, presence of deletion 5q provides a target for treatment such as lenalidomide, where durable response rates, high response rates had been reported. So I think those patients are appropriately treated with lenalidomide. So the intermediate risk group, again, one could treat as lower or higher risk based on other disease features or risk features according to the NCCN guidelines. So I think in summary, risk assessment or risk stratification is a very important step in MDS. It allows us to tailor the therapy accordingly. What we try to do is we try to weigh the benefit of certain treatments we are offering versus the complications, side effects, or mortality related to those treatments, namely when we think of allogeneic stem cell transplant. Those patients that have higher risk disease that are expected to have short overall survival from the disease itself, high rate of AML transformation, are probably appropriate for consideration of allogeneic stem cell transplant upfront, where the risk will outweigh, the benefit will outweigh the risk. While those patients that have lower risk features, one could go stepwise approach for those patients. It definitely, the risk assessment provide very important information for patients and family about their disease. Obviously, in real life, it may be difficult to apply all those risk models. I would say the IPSS is still acceptable starting point. This can be supplemented by either the revised IPSS or the global MD Anderson risk model. And there is no doubt that over the coming few years, we'll be incorporating more of the molecular mutations or gene mutations into those risk models. Thank you for listening.